Tonight we're going to be talking with Paul Hellyer. He's one of Canada's youngest members of parliament. And what you're about to hear tonight is pretty dramatic. Light at the end of the tunnel. Wait till you hear. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Paul Hellyer was Canada's youngest member of parliament when he was first elected in 1949. Although Hellyer is best known for the unification of the Canadian Armed Forces and for his 1968 chairmanship of the Task Force on Housing and Urban Development, he has maintained a lifelong interest in macroeconomics. Former Defense Minister of Canada as well. Through the years, as a journalist and political commentator, he has continued to fight for all kinds of reforms and has written several books on the subject. Tonight we're talking with Paul about Light at the End of the Tunnel, a survival plan for the human. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Paul, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks, George. And yourself?
Good. It was good seeing you a couple of years ago at the conference in D.C.
Right. That was a first-class conference, wasn't it?
It sure was. Paul, give us a little background. Your name comes up on this program as much as any guest that we've had. And, you know, just tell us a little bit more about your background beyond what I just read.
Well, I've been in and out of politics all of my life. I guess that's one thing. And I'm still fighting. And you mentioned one of the issues. There are several issues that really grab me. And the book that you mentioned really mentions three that we have to address if we want to really save the planet as a habitable, hospitable habitat for the human species. I just don't think most people and none of the politicians that I know of are taking the situation seriously enough. So I'm still fighting to try and do something about these issues and. That means I've been in and out of the business for a long, long time. And I've just published two new books that were I tried to get out before the G20 meeting of world leaders.
Yeah,
they met here in Toronto just a little while ago, and it was a it was a rough situation. And unfortunately, we spent more than $1 billion on the preparing for the meeting, and then they came away with a decision that was really, in my opinion, bad for the people of the world. And so my mission, as it were, is to try and speak truth to power and address the issues that are really important, not for our generation particularly, although they are, but for our children's children and their children and generations to come. So that's what I've been doing, and I'm still doing it at my tender age.
Well, what's so important, Paul, and why I am so delighted that we've got you on the program tonight is because of who you are and your credibility. You know, we've got great guests on this program, and we've got phenomenal listeners, Paul, as you know, and they're from all walks of life. But we get calls from policemen and firemen and folks from all walks of life who see very strange things in the sky. They've been reporting this for years, and nobody takes them seriously except us on this program and
right.
some of the other, you know, internet radio shows that are out there doing a great job too. And here's someone like you with a strong political background who is in the inside. You know, you're a top person in government when you were there. And you're coming forward with an incredible story that I got to tell you is as profound and as important as anything I've ever heard. And I'm going to have a delight talking with you tonight for two reasons. One, because of the information you're going to give us, but two, because, you know, I'm learning things just from your book, Light at the End of the Tunnel. And from the folks that know you well, the Steve Bassetts, the Edgar Mitchells, who respect you wholeheartedly. And I want to thank you personally for coming on the program tonight.
Well, it was a real pleasure.
Let's talk about the book, because the book is the basis for the answer and the background of the information that you have been talking about for some years now. Tell us about this. Why did you write Light at the End of the Tunnel?
Well, it was because I'm afraid if we don't do something and do it right away, that the global warming issue is going to overtake us. It's very close to the point of no return. I have come to the conclusion that we have about 10 years to turn the situation around. And if we don't do that, that the world that we know is gone for a long time, if not forever. And this affects people all over the world. I had a guest here yesterday, as a matter of fact, from Bangladesh. And he was saying that if global warming continues at the present rate for a few years, that a lot of his country is going to be underwater. It's just going to disappear. And this is going to happen to parts of other countries and to some of the Pacific Islands. And not only that, but it's changing lifestyles. The people in the far north, the Inuit in our country of Canada, are finding that their lifestyles are changing because the ice is disappearing and they can't continue with their traditional ways of life. And the politicians aren't taking it seriously. They're talking about turnaround times of 30 or 40 or 50 years, when some of the best scientists in the world think that it's just we're on the cusp right at the moment. And I'm just being optimistic when I say we've got 10 years to turn it around. And I wrote the book because I think we can do something about it, theoretically anyway. It's within our power to do something about it. The problem is the political will, the determination to actually act. And I haven't seen very much of that. So the book is really, it was to influence leaders, but failing that, and they seem to be hard to get through to, we're going to have to try and get the message out to ordinary people all around the world and just have them take the situation in their own hands and let their leaders know that unless they do something, they're not going to vote for them. I think that's the only thing that politicians understand is if they're about to lose an election because they don't do what the people want them to. So the book is really it's a hard-hitting thing, as you know. Mm-hmm. It will upset a lot of people in many ways, but it has a lot of information that I think just about everybody should be familiar with and use it as a springboard for action and trying to get something done in the world before it's too late.
Paul, you made headlines a few years ago when the world finally knew that the National Defense Minister of Canada, former, believed that governments were suppressing information about UFOs. Tell me what happened there. How did you get to that point?
Well, as you know something of the background, I've had reports about UFOs when I was the Minister of National Defense, but also I'm a radical, as the introduction to the book points out, and I unified the Canadian Armed Forces. It took the Royal Canadian Air Force, the Canadian Army, and the Royal Canadian Navy and made them into one force in order to make them more effective, in order mm-hmm. to change the line of command so they wouldn't be fighting each other rather than working together in a common cause. And so that was sort of a war of its own and occupied most of my efforts in those days. And I wasn't as interested in UFOs and extraterrestrials in those days as I might have been. Well, certainly, looking back, I missed an opportunity, I guess. But since then, when I've been concentrating on first on the monetary issue and reforming the banking situation, which is absolutely critical to this whole thing, I've had friends saying, "Hey, you know, why don't you bring yourself up to speed on this extraterrestrial issue?" And I was busy. I've written 13 books, as you know. This is the one we're talking about is the 13th one. Took the longest of any. I've been working on it and researching it for about 3 years, and that's about almost twice as long as any of the other books that I have written.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's quite a few books for a retired politician. Anyway, Pierre Junot, a friend, kept sending me this stuff. And five years ago, I saw a book that he sent me the day after Roswell by Colonel Philip Corso. And I thought, boy, that looks like good summertime reading. So I took it with me to the lake and read it. And I kept saying to myself, this is real stuff. I don't read a lot of fiction, but the year before I'd read The Life of Pi, which is probably one of the most interesting books of fiction that I've read for quite a long while. And I said, could it be like that? And I said, no, there are too many names and places here that I recognize as Minister of National Defense, former Minister of National Defense, that I know about these people. And these are real people, and these are real places. And this is not something that's contrived. It couldn't possibly be. So I was reading it, sitting by the lake, relaxing, which I very seldom get the chance to do. A nephew came along and said, what are you reading? I told him. He said, well, I'm a skeptic. I said, well, that's your choice. It's a free country. At least that's what we keep saying. I'm not always sure. And so a couple of days later, he phoned me, and he said, I just phoned my friend, the general, and told him what you were reading. And he said, every word of it is true and more. And so he said, where can I get a copy of the book? And I told him. And he wanted to get right at it. Well, then by the time I finished, I started thinking of the policy implications that were involved. You know, what are the U.S. forces doing in conjunction with the extraterrestrials? How successful have they been in the back engineering of some of the power sources and the other things? And they've been working at it, as you know, for a long, long time now. Just looking at some records, and it goes back about 60 years or so that they've been actually working assiduously of trying to back engineer the alien technology, and with some of the brightest minds in the world working on it. Well, you can't work that long on projects without having produced something pretty spectacular. So I said, this involves the whole world. What kind of weapons, for example, are they making with the alien technology? What are they going to do with it? Are they going to get us into an intergalactic confrontation of some kind? I don't know. But I decided, hey, this is something that the people of the United States, who have been paying the bills for these 60 years for all of the things that have been going on, deserve to know. They paid for it. It's their property. They should know exactly what's been going on. And not only that, but the people of the world should know, because we're all citizens of the world, and what the United States Air Force and others do could be of critical importance to us as well. So I said, I've got to speak out. And before I did, however, I decided to phone the general. He was someone I had met in aviation display, and so Phil, my nephew, gave him a heads up that I'd be phoning him, and I phoned him, and even before I could more or less say hello, he said, every word of it is true and more. And then he spent about 20 minutes telling me about the more, which included, he said, face-to-face meetings between the United States citizens and military and the extraterrestrials.
That's remarkable.
So with that assurance, then I said, now is the time to go public. And you know the rest of the story. I decided to do it at the last minute. And this was prompted by Victor Vigianis and Mike Bird, that you know. And
yes.
So they got me into it, and that was just the beginning.
Was there any ridicule for you at the time that you went public?
I think not as much as I probably expected, because the way that governments, and especially the United States government, has dealt with this issue, as you well know, is to try and talk people out of it, to keep them quiet. And then if that fails, to try and paint a picture of them as someone who's getting old, or who's maybe been watching the moon too much, and or something like that. And it wasn't as bad as I thought it was, the one on the positive side, in the 5 years that have intervened, this last year or two, there have been more what I call straight stories in the mainline press. The first 2 or 3 years, there were practically none. And they were quite interested in what I was going to say, but then when I said it, they didn't report it. And more recently, though there have been, in our papers at least, and I know there have been on some shows in the United States, Larry King Live and others, yeah, there have been some serious discussions of this issue, which you would never have heard 5 or 10 years ago.
You're being beamed all over North America tonight, of course. We've got a huge audience in Canada. We're on a number of stations there and, of course, in the United States. Was this an American story, Paul, or did the Canadians know about this too? Did they participate in this technology exchange, or was it primarily just the United States?
It was primarily a U.S. story, although when I got more familiar with the subject, I bumped into information about someone who had actually worked in a department that I took over after I left defense, the Department of Transport. It was a chap by the name of Wilbert Smith, who seemed to be quite well known in UFO circles. And he was involved with the technology way back around, you know, the end of the 40s and the early 50s, and had access to people in the United States in the know. And Wilbert wrote a top secret memorandum to the head of the communications department, section of the Department of Transport, and said that this he had read a couple of books written by Americans, and he was convinced that it was true because it coincided with the some experimentation that he'd been doing. And he got the Canadian embassy in Washington to make some inquiries, and the information came back that yes, indeed, this was something that was real. And he said that it was more highly classified than the hydrogen bomb, and that a team headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush were starting to work on it and see how much of the how much of the technology they could reverse engineer. And he wanted the Canadian government to do some things, and they did a small project called Project Magnet. Unfortunately, it petered out after a few years, but certainly Wilbert Smith was convinced that the extraterrestrials were miles, light years ahead of us in technology, and B, that they were benign, and that C, that they had information that would make our lives look like, you know, fairy princesses if we just listened to them and act more as they do. In other words, you know, stop beating each other up and fighting and start cooperating for the good of all.
It didn't sound like we listened to them, or if we did, we didn't do anything with it. Huh?
I'm afraid we're not listening as closely as we should. Yes, and it's, you know, since then I have I've read many books, and some of them well written and well documented. And seen hundreds and hundreds of documents, some that were highly classified, and talked to all kinds of people. As you know, I've been briefed by a whole range of people with a lot of personal experience. Stephen Greer and Paula Harris was someone who introduced me to a lot of information and interesting people.
The list goes
on and on.
Paul, we're going to take this quick break, and then we're going to come right back and continue talking about light at the end of the tunnel, the survival plan for the human species. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with Paul Hellyer on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I now have my company BlackBerry, and I have my personal Droid X, and now I'm waiting for our apps for Streamlink, Coast Insiders, so I can do what a lot of you do with your iPhones. By the way, Streamlink is available for just pennies a day. All you have to do is go to coasttocoastam.com and sign up for that. When I come right back, it's more with Paul Hellyer, author of Light at the End of the Tunnel, and also the former Minister of National Defense for the country of Canada. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Paul, are you more convinced now than even before of this ET presence in this shared technology?
Well, there's absolutely no doubt. Frankly, there was never any doubt in my mind, because I am I'm very cautious in these areas. I don't say anything unless I'm certain that it's correct. If I'm not certain, I would hedge. But when I went public, I was absolutely convinced that that they're real. I said so. I still know that that is true. But of course, now I know a lot more about it, and a lot more about the things that are being looked at in various parts of the world. I don't think the United States is the only place where back engineering is being done, but I think it is the one area in the world where the most progress has been made. And one of the things, I guess, the one of the things that interests me most is that global warming can only be fixed if we've got some really first-class fuels to replace fossil fuels. And I'm convinced that, some of the people that worked in the black operations, including Dr. Michael Wolff, said that, 10 years ago, that the U.S. Military, in conjunction with, working alongside with the extraterrestrials, had developed exotic fuels, both zero-point energy and cold fusion. Well, I think that is probably true, but certainly we don't know. And I doubt if the President of the United States knows, because the way these things operate, they only tell the politicians what they want them to know. And as long as they keep putting up the money, that's all they really want. And one of the most important reasons, well, there's so many important reasons why disclosure is essential, but one of the most important reasons is to find out about these exotic fuels and start installing them right away. It's too late for any more offshore drilling. It's too late for new works in the Alberta tar sands. We have to act now, not 10 or 20 or 30, 40 years from now. And if the technology exists, we should be told about it and start working on it now, immediately. And I know from what I have heard of the extraterrestrials from good authority that even if the technology is not commercial
applications,
application ready, that they would give it to us if we asked them. Because, as you know from other people you've had on the show, that one of the things they're most concerned about is how we're our stewardship of the planet. And they want us to keep the planet intact as an ecosystem that's not only good for us, but good for them to visit us as well. And so I know that we could do it, but the Congress, I think, is going to have to act. The Congress has really been derelict in handing over so much money to projects that it doesn't know anything about, just taking somebody's word for the fact that it's a national security thing and that they're not entitled, just because they're the representatives of the people, that they're not entitled to know about it. And I think they're going to have to say, hey, no, that's not the way the system is supposed to work. This is supposed to be a democracy, and we're supposed to vote money for things that we think are in the public interest. And how can we tell whether it's in the public interest or not if we don't know what's going on? So I think the Congress is going to have to grasp the nettle and find out and set up some system that will really get the truth, starting, with things that everybody knows. When I say everybody, I mean those people who understand what's going on. Everybody knows, but then working their way up from there to the things that are so highly classified, and finding out just exactly what is there and the applications that they have for future benefit of mankind. And that I think is it's just absolutely top priority as far as I'm concerned. Well, then the third thing, maybe we can discuss this later, of course, is the how to finance it, and that's where we have to change the banking system to make it possible to finance the whole changeover in 10 years.
Paul, if you were still in government in Canada, knowing what you know right now, and you had the perfect right to talk about disclosure. I mean, the prime minister said, you know, Paul, do what you want to do. Do what you think you have to do. How would you announce that to us? What would you say?
Well, I guess I would first probably take the diplomatic way and talk to my counterparts in the U.S. government and say, how much do you know? How much have you been told? And are they keeping secrets from you? And if so, if you're supposed to be in charge, why don't you exercise your authority? And then discuss with them privately and hope that they would then make a joint release or come clean and start something, which is really all that you want. But one of the things that is in my book, and this isn't from me, this, as you know, Jim Sparks, who you must have had on the show, I'm sure, more than once probably, has suggested that there has to be an amnesty for the people who have been involved, the shadow government, and especially the hardliners, the cabal, as I call them in my book, because they've broken just about every law in the book, and it would be hard to get them to come clean, which some of them, I'm told, want to do or are ready to do if under the correct circumstances. It would be hard for them to come clean and start talking about things that might wind them up in jail for a considerable length of time.
They're in too deep now, Paul, aren't they?
Yeah, and so I think the amnesty and George got this idea from the extraterrestrials themselves, at least Jim Sparks did, I should say, and allowed me to use it in my book. So I think that is an essential part of the whole thing, that Congress would have to repeal the law that has to be repealed or pass a new law that gave general amnesty to all the people who have been involved in these things over the years so that they can come forward and say what I'm sure a lot of them want to say, because quite a few of the retired people are now talking. We're getting more whistleblowers all the time, as you know.
Absolutely.
And the number of people who are coming forward is now so great that the researchers are having trouble coping with all of them.
You just mentioned the shadow government, Paul. Are you convinced that there are governments above governments, governments that we don't vote for, governments that are controlling presidents or prime ministers or leaders of other nations?
Well, there's no doubt about how the system works. And Nathan Lapham, the editor of Harper's Magazine, said there were two governments. There's the provisional government and the permanent government. And the permanent government are the Fortune 500 companies, the high-priced lawyers that do their legal work for them, and the high-priced public relations people, if you want to give them the most polite name, that do their public relations for them. And then the top civil servants, both the military and civil, and that they really run the country, and that every once in a while you have a charade called an election, and you elect people who are supposed to be in charge. But it's very difficult for them to fight against the entrenched power of the permanent government, because it's there. Presidents come and go, prime ministers come and go, ministers of defense or secretaries of defense come and go, but they're there, and they just keep on keeping on, as it were. And so it's a toughie, but the Congress, and I think especially, has got to exert its authority, and I have suggested in my book that even if they have to threaten to cut off funds to get people to act, that they should do that, and it has to be a serious threat, of course, and follow up with some sort of a commission of inquiry with the counsel that are necessary for the kinds of interrogations that they would have to engage in to pry the truth out and find out what these people are up to, because some of it sounds pretty far out.
If we have this technology, Paul, and we got it from the ETs, whether it was from a crash at Roswell or some agreement. Why, in your opinion, aren't they telling it and sharing it with us? Is it because they want to make money and they know? And, you know, regardless of our thoughts, I'm a believer in the abiotic oil theory that the planet has an abundance. It doesn't matter. It's still burning. It's still polluting. And, it's still doing what it's doing. But why don't they get rid of this if they have that kind of technology? Is it all about money?
That would be the primary reason, I would think. As you know, it's hard to know who controls this technology. And some of the interesting literature written over the years and substantiated over the years is that President Eisenhower lost control of the ET file, and that it was seconded, more or less, by private industry. And so nobody knows exactly who's in charge. And the MJ-12, as it were, that President Truman established, there are rumors that that now has grown to MJ-36, and that some of the members are European. Well, who are they and why are they? And why are they in on decision-making decisions, processes that are not available to elected members of the U.S. Congress? And these are just, the number of questions to ask and the amount of information that is being withheld is just astronomical, and which is the best reason I can think of to get on with it right away.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about some of the controversial aspects of the book, of the message and light at the end of the tunnel. There are a couple. One, of course, and I want you to elaborate on it, Paul, is the Americans, of course, that we've been working with aliens from other planets for a very long time, back engineering their technology. You would think that they would get to a point, those who are giving it to us, and say, start using it. But give me your thoughts on all that.
Well, I think they are using it for, military purposes, some of it. And this is one of the concerns. But I don't think that they have the final say. Jim Sparks was told that there had been agreements for disclosure and that these treaties had been broken, as so many other treaties have been broken. And again, it's conjecture until we have a process established to get at the truth. What was promised by whom to whom? And why was the treaty broken? Why did we default on our promise to have disclosure years ago? And I think the extraterrestrials are totally frustrated with us because they know that we've got this wonderful planet and that God gave us to enjoy, and we're mucking it up. And they don't like what we're doing with it, but presumably they have some rules about direct interference, and all they can do is suggest or cooperate to the extent that we're willing to be amenable and to cooperate. And I think we're the problems.
You had mentioned that the banks are a lot of the problem, the way the financing system is built right now. Tell me about that.
Well, do we have enough time in this segment, or do you want to take that in another one?
Because we've got about 7 minutes now, and then we'll lead into a next hour, too.
Okay, well, most people don't know where money comes from. When I wrote my first book on the monetary system, I asked about 100 people, including doctors, lawyers, dentists, engineers, and newspaper publishers and newspaper editors-in-chief where money came from. And there wasn't one of them that knew, not one. And yet these are the people who are running the world.
I would say it comes out of thin air, basically, from the banks that make it and create it.
Yeah, this is you've got the essence. What they said was that the government prints it. And I said, well, if the government printed between 50 and 100% of the money, which is what they all said it did, then we'd have a very different system from the one we've got now. But in fact, over a couple of centuries, the banks have managed to wheedle by one means or another, a virtual monopoly in the creation of money. And the way they do it is if you go in for a loan to, say, $35,000 to buy a car, and you have collateral of some kind, as soon as they're satisfied with the collateral, they'll ask you to sign a note for $35,000 plus a prime rate of interest plus a bit, depending on the color of your eyes. And then they tap their computer, and presto, $35,000 appears in the in your account that you can go out and spend to buy the car. And that seconds earlier, that money did not exist. The problem is that it's created as debt, and it's debt that has to be repaid with interest.
Right.
And so now we have a worldwide system where more than 95% of the new money created every year is created as debt. But nobody, and debt on which interest has to be paid, but nobody creates any money with which to repay the interest, with which to pay the interest. So
that's paid back with debt money too, right?
That's paid back with debt money.
Yeah.
So you have a system that's like a balloon, and it just keeps getting blown up with more and more debt until the debt load gets too high, and then it's like a balloon with a pin stuck in it, and the system collapses. And that's what, of course, has happened 25 times since 1890, and the economists and others haven't figured out a solution yet. Well, the solution is really fairly simple. The federal governments worldwide own the patents to create money. They own it on behalf of the people. It was handed down from the sovereigns.
Mm-hmm.
And the sovereignty is what they have to exercise. They have given it away to licensed privately owned banks.
I call them the money changers, Paul.
Exactly, yeah. And so they have to take back some of this sovereignty and create some of the money on behalf of the people who own the patent. And if they did that, then they wouldn't have to borrow. The stupid thing, really silly thing, is that the governments who own the patent license these people to create money. Then if the governments run short, instead of creating a little bit for themselves to make up their deficit, which they have the right to do, that they go and borrow from the banks that they licensed, who create the money out of thin air to lend to them, and the governments have to pay the money back with interest, which means they have to raise taxes or cut back on programs, which they're doing all over the world now. And they just, you know, it's a form of slavery, George. And I have said that the present kind of world war is a war between the people of the world and the bankers of the world. And so far, the bankers are winning. And unless we take control of that issue and do something about it and do it very soon, millions of people who are unemployed, millions of people who are losing their houses, all these people all over the world are going to live in misery when they, in fact, don't have to, while the bankers are taking home these huge bonuses and living the life of Riley.
We'll talk more about this, Paul, and the ET presence when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.